From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. With an investigation brewing, New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson backs out of being the nominee for Commerce Secretary. Will this slow down the package for the stimulus? There's a small silver lining in the dark economic forecast. October was one of the worst months for housing prices, but there's good news. The stock market rallied last week and new unemployment claims actually decreased. Author and economist Dr. Julianne Malveaux is here to give us her wisdom on the state of the economy. She's the president of Bennett College. Hi, Dr. Malveaux.
Hi, Farai. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too. So let's parse out New Mexico Governor Richardson first. I mean, when we talk about the Commerce Secretary, what are we really talking about in terms of the position and what it would bring to the administration?
The Commerce Secretary is a person who promotes the health of U.S. businesses, especially small and medium-sized businesses, but all businesses. It's not the most critical position in the cabinet at all. Treasury is going to be far more involved in economic stimulus. Council of Economic Advisors is going to be far more engaged there. And, of course, we have Larry Summers as the advisor to the president on the economy. So the commerce person, chambers of commerce, those are their kind of constituencies. It's not a huge loss, but it is a setback. I don't think it slows down the stimulus, but it is a setback for the Obama team. The challenge here for Rye is that this investigation on Richardson, it's one of your basic investigations. Someone gave him $100,000 to various campaign committees, and then they got a contract for about $1.3 million, and the question is whether or not the governor was involved. But that investigation has been going on since the summer. So I'm surprised, given how thorough the Obama team has been, that this is something that's still, you know, that they hadn't vetted before.
People are asking if this is going to affect the overall transition, because the Obama team is widely credited by both sides of the aisle for being nonpartisan to a great extent in its picks, to picking people with experience. Is this going to derail some of the momentum that the Obama team has, especially as they're looking to make sure that there's a stimulus package in place?
I really don't think so. Again, I think that this was not the most important of the cabinet positions. I think there are others who carry on the economic work. I do think that this is a position he now needs to fill quickly. And certainly it undermines this notion of the team of rivals. You know, he has Hillary Clinton. He had Bill Richardson. These are people who had read against him in the primaries. And so that was, and of course, Richardson is Latino, and that, you know, helps with some balance and diversity issues as well. So I don't think he's going to find another Bill Richardson, but I would posit that there are lots of folk, and I'm sure they had a short list, who could well fill this position. It has to miss a half step, but it really doesn't. It's not the end of the world.
So Mr. Obama's heading to the Hill today to try to sell his version of the stimulus package. What do we know about what he wants?
He wants to create jobs, and, you know, there are many, myself included, who argue that he could be more aggressive about that. Most recently, we learned that he also wants to cut some taxes as a way to reach out to the Republicans on the other side of the aisle. He wants to do infrastructure development, which is very important. Again, that's one of the issues that I think is dicey for some of us, especially women, because infrastructure tends to hire men, especially white men, union men, and it doesn't really deal with some of the women's issues. But he wants to get some money pumping in the economy. As we look at the iteration after iteration, I think they're up to about $800 billion. And before it's over with, it might get to $1 trillion. And that's not a bad thing. It's bad from a deficit perspective, but it's not bad from the perspective of this economy is really floundering, and something needs to happen to jumpstart it. I mean, my encouragement, and I think many others, has always been think outside the box. So you don't want to just do stimulus as usual. You really want to do something that's just really impactful.
Let's run through a couple of the other indicators in this economy. You know, you've got the Dow Jones Index, which is this stock market index that got as high as 14,000 points. And now people are happy to see it cross the 9,000 barrier, which it did three times last week. Today, it seems shaky. So what are things looking like stock market-wise?
The stock market is not going to cross 10,000 in this first quarter of the new year. The 9,000, as you said, was shaky, but people were happy to see it, and it was in part because of the stimulus that Chrysler was being offered, in part because of anticipation. The stock market is an art as much as it is a science. So people's anticipations, people's expectations have to be factored in as well. And I think that what you're seeing with the fluctuations from last week and from today so far are that people aren't sure where the market is going, and so they're people who have money to invest are holding on to it, and we're going to see that for a little while. I think the more quickly the Obama team is able to get a stimulus package together, the more likely we're going to be able to see some legs on the stock market. But I would not be surprised if we sort of basically floundered between 8,800 and 9,500 in the next couple of months.
And we've talked a lot about how this affects people's retirement plans. From what you're hearing informally, have most people made any changes in their retirement plans, or they're just like, you know what, I don't know what to do, let me just leave this alone?
It really depends on their age, and basically their course of action should depend on their age. If they're 30, 40, 50, you know, the market's going to come back eventually. Don't worry about it. If you're 60 to 70, it has an immediate impact. If you were going to retire next week, Farai, you're going to get a lot less money than you would have if you retired a year ago. And those are the retirees who are looking at changes, talking to their financial advisors, trying to figure out what and how they can recoup at least something. You know, their 401ks are down, 40%.
So speaking of jobs and, you know, all the benefits that come with them, there are so many people who signed up for unemployment benefits, and the numbers of unemployed folks were at the highest since 1982. Last week, the numbers went down. Why do we think that is?
Part of it is a seasonal adjustment. Part of it is people who have been unemployed coming back into the labor market, dropping out. The unemployment numbers don't look any better, but the unemployment claims are down partially because there are fewer people who can claim. In other words, you can't even file a claim unless you've worked 26 weeks. So say you worked, you came back into the labor market, and you had a 10-week job. You don't qualify for unemployment insurance, although you'll still show up in the unemployment numbers.
What kind of safety nets exist once you don't qualify for unemployment?
There really are none. I mean, there are, if you are, social services, if you're at the bottom of the poor, you know, you have some dollars for people who have been homeless. It's very little money. But there are some social service dollars out there still, not very much. Food stamps are out there for people who are very poor as well. But once you don't qualify for unemployment, there just really isn't a lot out there for you. We've got people who are really in a position where they have nothing, where there's no help, there's no government help. They're relying on their families and friends. These are the people who are losing their homes, who are being evicted from their apartments, who didn't have much of a holiday season, who are still pinching pennies.
We're going to talk shortly after our break with a gentleman who was kind enough to come on and tell us about his job search. And so we're going to talk more about job searches in a moment. But overall, can you give us a picture of what to do right now? Although we're out of the holiday season, technically, a lot of businesses don't seem to be they don't seem to have fully taken stock of their situation. They seem reluctant to hire. Is that what you've seen?
Absolutely. And for right, some of the people who are really affected are people who are consultants, freelancers, and others. I have a couple of colleagues who said to me, every piece of work I had for the month of January has been canceled. So they, you know, a lot of organizations, universities, and others have freezes on discretionary spending. And what that really means is that the people who work with them are frozen from work that they might well do. So we're seeing lots of people who are really up in the air about what to do. The good news is hopefully it's a 1 or 2 month thing and that they have the resources, the savings, or something to maintain. But the bad news is that people who expected to be working are not working right now. So in addition to the numbers that we capture that 2.5 million jobs that we've lost in the past year. People who are self-employed and others, it doesn't really show up, but it shows up in terms of their ability to spend, their income, their flexibility. And so we have lots of Americans who are really distressed right now, and there really is not a lot for them. We don't do anything for self-employed people. If your business isn't going well, your business isn't going well. And we've got, you know, hundreds of thousands of people who are in that position.
What do you see ahead in terms of trends for employment in the sense of how many people do you think will, I mean, do you think that overall people will try to leave the freelance economy and go to, 9-to-5 jobs? And if so, is there going to be anything opening up?
Well, you do see a bit of that as well, and it's very interesting to see. We have a couple of job searches open at Bennett, and we've got a couple people who, you know, they've been outside by all accounts. If you looked at them on paper, they look very successful, and they're like, I need to come inside. You know, they want right. to come inside because they want the security of a regular paycheck, which is something that, you know, a year ago they just didn't think was something that was that important for them. So I do think that the good news for employers is that you're going to get a better pool of people looking for work. You're going to be able to afford people who are far more qualified than the people that you were looking at for the same jobs a year ago. The bad news for people is that someone who was making, you know, six figures in a consulting gig is probably now willing to settle for a bit less, and it has an implication on everything they do in terms of, you know, their spending and all of that. So we're in a place where, you know, those who have cash, those who can hire, those who can spend, are really in the catbird seat. But those who do not have cash are being forced to make compromises that they may well be uncomfortable with.
Just quickly, how important are benefits packages to workers these days? Are people looking for cash when they have the option of taking a job, or also at benefits?
They're looking for benefits as well. The whole health insurance thing is very big for a lot of people, especially for people who have been outside, especially as they age and as they have children and as they have other things where they really want that health insurance package. I think that pensions are a little bit less important for people, but a lot of people are asking about the health insurance, are concerned about the health insurance, and are willing to make some compromises to make sure they can get on a good health insurance plan.
Well, Dr. Malvo, stay with us. Thank you so much for agreeing to do so. And we're going to talk to John Smith in a second. He's been out of work since September. We're also going to ask if the new year will bring him new opportunities as well as other folks. Plus, ask what's driving the homicide rate up for black male teenagers. Our bloggers will tackle that one. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. The new year can be a good time to start over. Plenty of people who lost jobs in 2008 are hoping to get new ones in 2009. James Smith is one of those people. When we caught up with him last year, he was planning to leave the country in search of jobs overseas. And I just want to welcome you back. I'm so glad you could come back on the show.
Thank you.
So Dr. Malvo, Dr. Julianne Malvo, our economics expert, is also with us. But I want to ask you, you know, you were laid off in September from a sprinkler plant in Southern California. It was a layoff at the time, but you didn't have high hopes that they would hire again. Have they made any indications that they're going to open up some jobs?
Not at all. In fact, the permanent employees at the plant have been off for more than 30 days now.
Right. Right. So that door is closed for you. You were looking at any number of options inside and outside the country. What have you found as you've been going around trying to look for work?
Well, the work I find here, they're saying I'm overqualified. What work there is being offered, and other people just aren't responding at all. So I'm finding it almost impossible to find a job. So I'm kind of gearing up to leave.
And when you say leave, where would you leave to go?
Well, I have a few friends in Costa Rica, and I'm considering going there. But I'm also looking into Dubai. There's a lot of building going on in Dubai, and some money to be had there.
So when you came on last time, you told us a bit about your history in the military and also having a record. And how do you think both of those have affected? I mean, is there an upside to you having been in the military that kind of balances or makes people think about the other issues you've dealt with?
You know, I don't know what goes on in everyone else's minds, but it seems like it makes no difference that I served in the military, nor for how long. It's simply I am what I did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I committed a crime, and I am that.
Dr. Malveaux, what about for people who have records, particularly felony records, which can show up on employment applications? What advice do you have?
People have got to use their networks. I mean, many employers do discriminate against people with felony records, and from a larger public policy perspective, we need to begin to talk about ways to expunge people's records to make sure, especially if these are drug-related crimes and other crimes, that their records can be expunged after a period of time in which they've lived crime-free. But that doesn't help the brother that we're talking to at all in the short run, Mr. Smith. So what people have to do is use their networks, get their foot in the door, have someone who can bring them along and help them. That's harder to do now than it was 2 years ago because jobs are just hard to come by. And the basic employer is going to look at a record, someone with a record, someone without a record, and they're going to pick the person without the record. And that's just real. It's not fair. It's not right, but it's real.
James, how do you feel like your network is serving you? Do you think that there are people who are willing to try to at least recommend you for the jobs that are out there?
Truth is, I don't have much of a network. I've come back out to... I'm on my own here.
Mm.
So I'll do what I can.
I would also suggest to you that you go to organizations that are focused on helping especially African-Americans and especially African-American men find employment. The Urban League movement will, I don't know what city you're in, but many of the Urban Leagues will have job development programs that will work with you to help you find something. Again, it's just a harder time than it's ever been before, but that is a definite resource. Many cities have some form of job development program, especially for people who have had some challenges, and that represents a resource as well. Finally, I think, the Veterans Affairs Departments and their offices in many cities can be helpful to you. Again, you sound extraordinarily determined. If you're interested in thinking about leaving the country, it would suggest to me that you also should be as aggressive in looking at the opportunities that exist here in the United States, understanding the kinds of discrimination that exists. The last thing I would say is that many people in your position have found self-employment, with its ups and downs, a way to make sure that income comes in. You're trying to earn an income, and there may be some ways that you can create your own opportunities. And again, I realize that's easier said than done, but that does represent a possibility.
Well, James, since you are in a forum with hundreds of thousands of people listening to your story, what do you consider your strengths?
I am a bulldog. You give me the job, and it will get done. It doesn't matter what I have to sacrifice to get it done. I come to work every day. I come to work early. I enjoy my work most of the time, and when I don't enjoy it, I do it anyway.
It sounds like you still have that discipline. You may have walked into the military with it, but it sounds like a very military-style discipline that you bring to your work.
It is.
That's right. People are looking for good, hard workers, even as the unemployment situation churns. I mean, people are hiring every day. So that discipline will take you a very long way, and that's a discipline that you're going to need to use to find another kind of opportunity for yourself. People are laying off, but the same, other people are hiring. And so you've almost got to be laser-focused. What I tell people who are unemployed these days is you have to treat your unemployment like it's a job. In other words, I know unemployed people who basically are down, depressed. You don't sound like that. So the same 40 hours that you would give an employer, you need to give yourself in terms of the job search.
Well, James, we definitely want to continue to stay in touch with you as you follow your search. So once
and
again,
good luck.
Absolutely. Once
thank
again,
you.
I appreciate it. And Dr. Malveaux, thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
We were speaking with James Smith. He was laid off from a manufacturing job in September. He's now collecting unemployment and looking for work in Southern California or wherever he can find it. We were also speaking with economist Dr. Julianne Malveaux, the president of Bennett College. A parody song called Barack the Magic Negro continues to cause political fallout, and one of the Gina Six reportedly attempts suicide. We've got these stories and more on today's Bloggers Roundtable. With us, Sean King of Sean in the City's blog, Jasmine Canick, who blogs at jasminecanick.com, and Eric Brown, who blogs for the Detroit News. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hey, Farrar. How are you doing?
So, well, Barack the Magic Negro, the song that would not quit. There's a conservative, Chip Saltzman, running for chairman of the Republican Party. And in December, he distributed this CD with the song Barack the Magic Negro, sung to the tune of Puff the Magic Dragon. It was originally broadcast on Rush Limbaugh's radio show last year. Let's take a listen.
Barack the Magic Negro lives in D.C. The L.A. Times, they call him that 'cause he's not authentic like me. Yeah, the guy from the L.A. paper said he made guilty whites feel good. They'll vote for him and not for me 'cause he's not from the hood.
All right, Eric. I'm not sure about the musicianship or the content, but here, you know, spokespeople for the Republican Party have pointed out that this came from an editorial piece in the L.A. Times that, you know, from a black man. But deconstructing or attempting to deconstruct the issue of the magic Negro, do you think that the fact that this topic was originally brought up by a black person justifies the parody?
In no way does it justify the parody. What it does do is give white people a reason to continue playing it because they could justify it by saying a black person brought this up. Same with here in Michigan when the Prop 2 situation with regard to affirmative action was brought up. Everyone was saying, well, Warwick Connerly is behind it, so why not other blacks? So all they need is at least one black to be in the front of something, and that's their attempt to say, is they okay now?
Jasmine, when you think about the whole conversation about what is appropriate political dialogue, what do you think's fair game and not? Some people have said that Barack Obama has gotten away with not being parodied enough.
Look, this particular piece to me is hilarious just in the fact that, you know, you have to do your research. I mean, I know a little bit about the writer of the original op-ed piece, and it's funny to me just because a lot of people consider him to be that the same kind of person he made Barack out to be for white folks. So I just find that hilarious. But I also just think, I had a bigger issue with it being distributed. I had an even bigger issue with Steele and Blackwell defending it. I felt like they needed to be time warped back to somebody's plantation in the early 1900s to be reminded of what their race is.
You're talking about Michael Steele and
Ken Blackwell,
two of the leading
prominent black Republican members who defended, you know, this piece being distributed. You know, they need to be checked a little bit. But I think obviously a lot of things are fair game in politics. I just don't think it's appropriate for this type of piece to be distributed by a candidate who's hopeful to lead the Republican Party. And it's just a reminder to people like me and other African Americans, we still got a lot of racism to deal with. Just because, you know, Obama is going to the White House doesn't mean all is well.
Sean, we've had folks on like Michael Steele who are within the Republican Party and black who say, you know, the party's got a lot of work to do when it comes to dealing with race. And Jasmine pointed out that he was defending this situation a bit. But overall, does this say that the door is shut for dialogue around race and the Republican Party?
No, but I agree with Jasmine. I mean, I was just baffled when Steele and Blackwell, they were some of the few people, some of the only people that kind of stood up and defended it. If nothing else, this ridiculousness gives us an opportunity to continue the dialogue, but it's pretty preposterous. I mean, I think Saltzman, it was kind of a career killer for him. And the thing is, you kind of expect it from Rush Limbaugh, but Saltzman is kind of mainstream. I mean, he was the campaign manager for Huckabee. He was a leading contender for the RNC position, so even though I understand they're trying to put it back on the L.A. Times, he kind of gave it new legs and breathed new life into something that really had kind of died and passed away. So It may close doors, but I'm hoping that it will open more doors than anything else, even though I know that wasn't their intention.
Well, I want to move on to what sounds like a very sad incident. One of the teens involved in the Gina Six case in Louisiana reportedly tried to commit suicide. We're talking about 18-year-old Michael Bell, and he suffered a gunshot wound to the chest. And 2 weeks ago, he was arrested for allegedly stealing $370 worth of clothes from a department store. We're talking here, of course, about the Gina, Louisiana case in which six black teens faced felony charges for beating up a white classmate after a racial incident at a school. And in an interview with CNN, Bell said he felt he would be letting down everyone if he got into more trouble. Eric, what does this say about the reverb of the case? And do you personally have empathy for Bell, given his situation?
I have empathy from him. He made a point saying that he felt that he was letting down those that had so much faith in him. And from that standpoint, I'm not a psychiatrist, so I have no idea why people want to kill themselves. But under the same token, there is a lot of weight on him. He felt that he let down so many people. So the sense of that embarrassment is probably what drove him to wanting to do what he did to himself. That's not making any excuse for what he did, but I can understand if those are his sincere words. I can understand where he's coming from in a sense.
Jasmine, what do you make of this situation? And also, what might be a good course of action moving forward for people who've been following this case?
You know, the jury's still out for me. I have a lot of mixed feelings about it. I was very disappointed. But, you know, one of the things that I read that kind of moved me the most, which I could really understand, is the media. And the reason why I mentioned that is because this morning there's a lot of media attention on Barack Obama's daughters and their first day of school. And I thought about Michael Bell because, you know, just that feeling, some people get off on the paparazzi and being followed around. Some people aren't used to it, and some people don't know how to deal with the media following them everywhere. And somewhere I read about how he had he didn't like all the media attention, and that was really weighing down on him. And I can definitely relate to that and understand that. I think that
what's the flip side when you say you're conflicted a bit about this?
Well, you know, right is right and wrong is wrong, you know, and you know, obviously as someone, I mean, we had this conversation last year or, you know, rather around this whole situation. I mean, so a lot of us black, we put a lot of energy into this. A lot of us, you know, some of us went down there and we had a lot of high hopes for these young men. So that is sort of the flip side of it for me. But I definitely can understand. I do have empathy. I hope that whatever is troubling this young man, he could work past it because it's never too late.
Go ahead, please.
Before you go to Sean, let me make one point. Just like today, Nathaniel Abraham, who was the youngest person ever to be convicted in the state of Michigan as an adult, he was sentenced again today to a few years in jail. And this goes back to when he came out of jail at 21 because they decided not to put him in prison for the rest of his life when he was convicted as a, 12, 13-year-old. And now he's going back to jail again. He let down so many people in the community that it is just amazing. So I can kind of empathize with the situation Michael Bell is going through because he did let down a lot of people, same with Nathaniel Abraham up here in Michigan.
Let me talk about that. You know, I think the danger is these young brothers, the Gina Six, Nathaniel Abraham, these brothers had major issues before their cases blew up, particularly dealing with Gina Six. I mean, these guys grew up in a very tough town, and we kind of made heroes out of them and started setting standards on who they are, and they kind of became typecast, I think, as somebody that they never were.
Right.
And these guys, and here's the truth. As folk heroes. And these guys have major family problems, family struggles. Some of these guys are adopted, come from broken homes, live in great poverty. And we've made them into, you said it, folk heroes. And now they're having to live out their problems on a national stage. And I'm curious, who's helping them get through these issues?
Right.
So we can say we're disappointed, but who is helping these young brothers? Who's mentoring them and who's guiding them? Because I know particularly Michael Bell has moved from city to city and state to state, and the brother is really struggling.
I have to jump in, and we're going to keep you guys over a break. Thank you. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. We are back with our bloggers roundtable with Sean King from Sean in the City, Eric Brown from the Detroit News, and Jasmine Canik of jasminecanik.com. And we were just talking about an apparent suicide attempt by Michael Bell, one of the Gina Six. But I want to move on to talk about homicide. There was a report released by criminologists at Northeastern University, and they found between 2002 and 2007 the rate in which young black males died of homicide increased by a staggering 31%. Number of young black men accused of murder increased by 43% during the same time. And the report places the blame on federal cutbacks on community policing and juvenile crime prevention. So when you think about the report, the numbers, and the blame, Sean, what do you think of this idea that it's really about the criminal justice system as much as it is about the people?
Well, that's partly true. I mean, I do think that it's not a coincidence that we've had so many cutbacks in community programming and community policing, not just on the federal level, but even on the state and local level. I mean, here in Atlanta, we had 25 recreation centers, and 22 of them closed just a few months ago because of cutbacks in the city. And so these things definitely are part and parcel to the cause of teen violence. But one thing that concerns me is it's very easy to point your finger at a big, large system, but that doesn't really change the problem. And so I wish that local community voices and community organizations and churches and other people that operate in all the cities where violence is going up, from Houston, Atlanta, Los Angeles, Chicago, I wish they were doing more and could organize and come together more to have a greater presence in the community.
Jasmine, it sounds like that's right up your alley. You do a lot of work in communities here in Los Angeles. What do you think could help? What do you think is a set of solutions that might work around this?
Well, before I say that, the one thing I do want to say is that report was from, 2002, 2007. You know, right now we're in the middle of sort of like an economic crisis, and I'm sure those numbers are going to substantially change and for the worse, because we already know that when times are hard for people, we do desperate things. And I've seen a lot of that going on here in Los Angeles. I also think that, you know, while I do think the criminal justice system does play a role, please do not discount nor forget the family, because that is where, you know, where everything starts. You know, I hear sometimes I hear mothers and grandmothers and people say, well, where do these gangbangers come from? Well, why don't you look in your back bedroom, look in that converted garage you letting your grandson sleep out of, you know, look in your own house first. You know, when we let go, or if we were never there to begin with, because you have to remember, crack plays such a devastating role in a lot of black families and tore our families apart. You have a lot of broken families. So I think it's a mixture of not only the community organizations, but also a renewed sense of family and values and just not letting go and holding on. I know at one point, believe it or not, I was headed down the wrong track, but my grandmother wouldn't let go, you know.
She straightened you out, huh?
For as much as she could. And look at me today. But, you know, but it's that part. And we forget that, you know. And we, for those young men and women who don't have a mother, a father, a grandmother that's there, then that's where people like myself or big sisters, big brothers, community organizations need to come into play. And I agree with the brother who was talking about the 25 centers that were closed. We have that same problem here in Los Angeles. Pools closed, tennis courts closed. There's nowhere to steer these young people.
Eric, when you think about this situation, there's been a lot of controversy over even talking about the family, the black family, because there has been you know, there have been moments where people have used the black family as a lever to really attack. How can there be a conversation about what families need to do that's respectful but firm?
Well, Jasmine hit the nail right on the head when she said it starts with the family. And even to piggyback with what Sean said, talking about the Michael Bell situation, where are the mentors in the area? Where are the community activists? Where are the churches with regard to having conflict resolution programs? I mean, there's a myriad of institutions that can help. And I'm not one to always want to blame the economy or what's going on in society as a reason to commit crime. I mean, a lot of people want to do that, but there's still a basic fundamental fact that we all know right from wrong. And I think that, one, you know, you can't blame the family on the one hand, and then on the other hand you say the family is responsible. There needs to be some programs set aside to make sure people are going down the right track. And Jasmine is a perfect example. She said she was headed down the wrong track once upon a time in her life. Her grandmother straightened her out. So there needs to be family members. It don't have to be a grandmother. It don't have to be a brother, sister. It could be an uncle. It could be a close family member. Someone needs to play a role in righting all these wrongs that are taking place throughout the country in black communities, more or less.
All right. We only have a tiny little window left, but Eric, I'm going to give you the final word. Are you hopeful that there's going to be a focus on this in the next administration, say?
Well, not just in the next administration, but throughout the country, all the urban areas, we continue to elect these Democratic members to represent us, make them do their job, hold them accountable.
All right. On that note, guys, thanks so much.
Happy New Year.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
We were talking to Sean King from Sean in the City. He joined us from Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. Eric Brown blogs for the Detroit News. He joined us from WDET in Detroit, Michigan. And, of course, Jasmine Canik blogs at jasminecanik.com. And she was here with me at NPR West. Theirs was an unlikely romance. She was a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, and he was a career soldier devoted to his unit. But their love blossomed despite the differences. In 2005, Dana Kennedy's fiancé, Charles King, was deployed to Iraq. He started writing a journal to their infant son in case he didn't make it home. First Sergeant Charles King was later killed by a roadside bomb. Dana Kennedy turned King's 200-page journal to his young son into a memoir called A Journal for Jordan, A Story of Love and Honor. I talked to Dana about her new book and started by asking her to describe the kind of woman she was when she met Charles.
When I met Charles, dear, wonderful man who turned out to be the love of my life, and I certainly didn't think he was going to be the love of my life when I met him, I was pretty immature, very career-oriented. And then I met this gentle, kind warrior, is the only way to describe him, a military man, and he changed me. Just his gentleness and his grace and his loyalty, and it took me years to believe he was really as good as he turned out to be. And we had a wonderful 8 years together in between the times I broke up with him.
Yeah, you guys, you seem, I mean, first of all, the book is very evocative about your relationship, and then later your relationship to your child, his relationship to your child. But it seems to me that you kind of, you like, you know, the military obstacle courses, you kind of put him through one of those.
I put the brother through it. Yes, I did. you know, my father was a drill sergeant in the military, and I just never wanted to marry a military man. I grew up near military bases, and, you know, so here comes this military guy, and I thought, oh, my gosh. Plus, he was my father's friend, and I thought, well, what girl wants to be with her father's friend? And I didn't want a military man, and it was the best thing. Being with him was the best decision I ever made. He taught me so much about honor and dedication and loyalty. He truly was an amazing person. But as I say in the book, it's called A Journal for Jordan. It's literally written to my son. I don't want my son, who's 2 years old, our son Jordan, to think his father was a saint. He wasn't. And, I'm not perfect. And so I talk about our flaws and the flaws in our relationship. But I tell you, it was a really beautiful relationship, and losing him broke me inside. And so now I'm at a place where I'm trying to live with my grief with some measure of dignity, and to demonstrate to my son that even in the face of tragedy, you can go on to reclaim your life and reclaim your happiness, and that's what his father would have wanted for us.
The journal is very literal.
Yes.
What is the journal, and what was that about?
Mm-hmm. When I was 5 months pregnant, we actually decided to have the baby because he was going to Iraq. And I was turning 40 years old, and we felt like we were running out of time to have a child together, so we made the decision to do that. And then also, he might not come back from Iraq. And so we decided not to wait until he came back, and thank God, I got pregnant and with our son. And he left when I was 5 months pregnant for the war. And the entire time he was gone, from before our baby was born, he was writing a journal to him. He would go out on his missions during the day, come back into his bunk in Iraq in the evenings after his missions, and he would write to our son, even before Jordan was born, as I say. And he wrote life lessons. He wanted Jordan to know what his values were, what he believed in, if he didn't come home to raise him himself. And so he told him everything from how to treat a woman to the power of prayer to practical things like hide money in your shoe on vacation, anything he could think of. He told him his favorite Bible verses. He told him why he loved me, why he wanted a son. And it's just a guide that will help me raise my child.
You are someone who is so incredibly accomplished. You're part of a Pulitzer Prize winning team from the New York Times. I mean, you were part of that. And at the time that you and Charles were trying to figure out what you wanted, what would you say to other people, particularly Black women, but just all women who are trying to decide, well, do I need a guy who's a little more, you know, polished, a little more urbane, because you had to make a choice?
That is just such an important question. And I think one that people answer in different ways as they walk through their lives and mature a little bit. You know, in my 20s, I wanted the guy who wore the suit and, you know, read the Wall Street Journal and so forth. And it was selfish. It was egotistical. It was immature. I was still a good person, but I just had this image of what I wanted. And what I realized over time and actually from being with this man is that character is what matters. And I tell you, once I made the decision to look at him for who he was, this man with strength and honesty and decency, it became a love like I've never known. I mean, this is a man who didn't make a lot of money, but gave me every dime he had for our baby. This is a man who, when I said I'd like to have a child, said, absolutely, let's do it. I've been waiting for you to be ready. If I would wake up coughing in the middle of the night, he'd get up and get me water. He loved me for who I am. I could gain weight, lose weight, cut my hair, you know, grow my hair. None of that mattered. What mattered to him was the person inside. And there's no greater love than that.
At the same time, you have a very honest assessment in the book about what it means for a man in the military, like Charles, to prioritize his unit. Do you feel in the end that he made the right decision to prioritize, to take some risks, ultimately one that cost his life?
You know, I don't have a definitive answer for that. And one day I'm going to have to answer that question for my son. And one day, you know, I say to myself, yes, he made the right decision because he was such a warrior. And if he had let someone else take the risks that he took that ultimately killed him by the improvised explosive device, he wouldn't have come back the same man. On the other hand, I look at my little boy who's starting to ask, where's my daddy? And he's 2 years old, and I'm having to try to explain that to him, and it breaks my heart. And I think, my gosh, you shouldn't have gone on that mission. It was a volunteer mission. And he had gone on dozens, maybe hundreds of them in the year that he was gone. And so personally, I wish he hadn't done that. On the other hand, it was because he did it that he was who he was, that he, you know, you can say somebody has honor and loyalty and commitment and dignity, but he demonstrated it. I mean, one of the other ways he did that was, and this really angered me, was his decision not to come home when our baby was born. He had just been at war 3 months, and he was a first sergeant. He was a leader of a lot of men, and many of them were young. And he ultimately decided that he couldn't leave them in battle. They were just getting acclimated. But he had promised me he was going to come home. And that really, really affected our relationship for a time. And I had to make peace with it. And ultimately, I did.
And he did get to see Jordan. And they got to spend some quality time together. And then once he went back, he, with very little time left on the clock before he would have come home, he was the victim of an attack. And you investigated what happened. Why did you do that?
You know, I had to know. I had to know to be able to make peace with it and go on with my life and maybe even answer questions for my son one day. I had to know the truth, and I had to know what happened. And the other thing is, I could not just bury him and go on with my life and go back to work. I had all of this stuff inside of me, anger, pain, fear, anxiety, and I was either going to do something positive with it or something negative with it. And I think that that's true for many people in life when you're struggling with something so painful and so overwhelming and so fearful that, you know, you have one or two ways to go. And what I decided to do was to turn all of that energy into a positive direction and write this book and try to share with people some lessons that I learned. And one is the importance of communicating with your family, of speaking to your family, writing about how much you love them before time runs out. We're an example of that. And I also wanted a way for my son to really know his father. And I wanted to share Charles and his spirit and his legacy with as many people who care to read the book. And I hope people do, because I do think it's a remarkable story, not just because it's my story. It's actually the story I never wanted to tell, because that would mean he's home. But I had to do this.
So what's next for you? What do you, I mean, besides raising Jordan, mm-hmm. what do you see as your path?
It's interesting because I've always been someone who's been sort of focused on career and had my eye on the next thing ahead. And right now I just want to linger in this moment with my son, who looks so much like his father and brings so much joy to me. I don't know what's next. I honestly have no answer for that. I'm taking it one day at a time, and you know, I'm still grieving really, really badly. I'm happier than I was a year ago, but I, for the first time in my life, I'm not worried about tomorrow. I'm just living in the moment, because one of the things that Charles's death showed me is that you only have this moment. Time is not guaranteed to us. And I know that's so often a cliche, but I really am trying to live that now.
Dana, I'm so glad that we got a chance to talk. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That was Dana Kennedy. She's the author of A Journal for Jordan, A Story of Love and Honor. She joined us from NPR Studios in New York.